Blog Talk Radio.
Hey everyone, Kaylin Patterson, Midwest Muscle, PP Talk in the house. And this program is sponsored by P4P Muscle, the number one drug free sponsorship foundation in the world. And if you are a drug free athlete and are looking for a solid foundation to stand on and a vehicle to drive your goals, check us out at P4PMuscle.com. And now let's talk. And if you're wondering why I'm not as jovial as normal, it's because we have a very serious topic today, and we have a very qualified person to basically deal with this situation. And I want to make sure I'm saying his name right. Delaine Cunningham. Okay. She's going to be helping us walk through a very serious and a very different kind of conversation, one that we've been having, but one that we haven't been able to address fully simply because we aren't as knowledgeable. And we had to get someone that knows what they're talking about. They can basically answer your questions so we can make sure that we're asking correctly and with the, I guess, the seriousness of what's really happening. So, Kalane, I want to make sure I'm saying it right, because the one thing I hate is butchering somebody's name.
Shalene.
Okay, there we go. Now, just introduce yourself, give the listeners your background, and then we'll get into some of their questions that they have, because obviously we've had a lot of listeners that have had either a friend or family member or a close friend in their life, and it's not something to joke about, and, you know, we don't have the answers, and usually when you don't have the correct information, you use false information as a substitute, and it's a poor substitute at best. So please introduce yourself, and we'll get this show started.
Thank you. My name is Shalene Cunningham. I am a clinical social worker. My credentials include an MSW, a master's in social work, as well as being a licensed independent social worker, which represents the LISW behind my name. I've been doing this for approximately 10 years, so about a good decade, working with all different types of populations in the mental health world. And sadly, one thing that has been a constant in my work has been the prevalence of suicide, which is the reason that I'm going to be talking with you folks today.
Yes, and there's just no way to walk into this without actually just walking into it, because like I said, it's something that a lot of people don't like to talk about. You know, it can never happen to me, for one. I'm too strong to have something like this happen to me, for two. And also, you know, the people that I'm involved with, I basically support them in a way where this will never happen. And these are all basically, I guess, false narratives we give ourselves because we don't want to actually deal with the topic or address it and, you know, basically help the person that might be standing right next to them, maybe days or even hours away from taking their own life. So, you know, what are some of the signs? What are some of the symptoms? I don't know if that would bring this about. And what can be done to immediately help the person and then help the person long term?
Sure. What a lot of people don't understand and need to realize is when you're talking about suicide, people have all kinds of different opinions and judgments. It's one of those things in our society that, you know, it's in our face, but it's still very taboo. It's like sex.
Yes.
You know, you can talk about it within a certain realm, but then once things get too far out of the comfort zone, we want to start judging and we don't want to understand. And so what people need to know first and foremost about suicide is that, you know, people will say it's a selfish act. It's not a selfish act. The person that has a suicidal mind feels so hopeless and so helpless in whatever darkness is happening in their lives that 9 times out of 10, what they're wanting to do is just stop pain. And that usually 90% of the time is mental pain, emotional pain. They are so much into a dark hole that they don't feel like there's a way to come out, and a lot of times feel as though they're nothing more than a burden to the world, to their families, to their friends, coworkers, et cetera. So it's really a counterintuitive way of thinking about suicide from what we sadly get misrepresented with by TV shows, movies, maybe even songs, maybe even sadly, you know, the celebrities that make the news that have committed suicide. In terms of what to look for, the majority of the time, you are going to find that someone definitely attempts and often completes suicide if they, in fact, have some sort of mental health issue that they're dealing with. And when I say mental health issue, the number one issue is depression. Along with that, if you pair substance use or abuse or addiction, it can be a recipe for disaster. A lot of times people will they'll just act in a different manner than usual. They won't be able to function in a way that they normally do. You may see a decline in hygiene. You may see a decline in grooming. You may see a decline in productivity. Or you may see someone who has been what we use in the mental health world a lot, the term melancholy, meaning just sort of a low-grade, down mood constantly that suddenly becomes upbeat, suddenly has this mask on that they're happy and there's not a care in the world. Perhaps that person may start giving away items that are very sentimental or important to them to others, that it doesn't really make sense why all of a sudden this person would want to get rid of this item or that item. You know, there's a lot of stereotypes and I hate to use the word cliches, but cliches about suicide historically. You know, a lot of times people will say historically, or would have said historically, if someone's talking about committing suicide, it's absolutely just for attention seeking. Don't pay it any attention. They're not going to do anything. That's a myth. Everybody's different. Every situation is different. You never want to take it to be a joke or in attention-seeking manner if somebody starts speaking of suicide. And there are others that will not discuss how they're feeling and that they are suicidal. A lot of what you want to look for is going to be based, sadly, on the individual. It's not a one-size-fits-all scenario. And that's what makes this topic even harder to discuss and breach.
Yeah. Now, the first one comes from Dana, and she's basically, she had her cousin, which was a male, that had taken his life, and there were warning signs, but people had basically been dealing with, you know, the man can't, supposed to be tougher, supposed to represent manhood better and not, you know, cry out or be a baby or wimp. How hard is that for the male with those kind of thoughts and, you know, ideas, they're willing to open up fully to basically express what's happening in their mind?
Sure, that's a great question. It absolutely is hard. And again, I'm not going to repeat myself over and over again throughout this podcast saying it's a case-by-case, you know, situation. It is. That's my general statement. However, you know, again, there's so many things that I hope we touch on throughout this podcast that we can dispel some of the myths and touch on some of the stereotypes and the hot topics and the tragedies that we have going on in our society that play into suicide itself. And so to answer Dana's question, it can be extremely difficult for males. You know, sadly, in 2017, males still are taught widespread, you know, I'm not speaking about specific individuals or specific cultures, but widespread in our society, males still can't cry. It's a sign of weakness. You know, males have to be macho. Males have to pull themselves up by their bootstraps. And so living in a society where that, again, is the widespread message, it would be absolutely difficult for a male to be suffering and to feel comfortable going to certain resources. Maybe even if that were a female close relative or family member or female professional in society and say, hey, I'm struggling with this and I need help.
Mm-hmm. And you know, when, like you said, let's start with the elephant in the room, I guess, and that's the state of the nation as a whole. And, you know, that's the one thing that people don't want to talk about is that society, to an extent, has been broken, and our leadership is not really leader-like. And, you know, basically everyone is saying how negative things are and how there's no hope. And they forget that the children are listening and that the younger minds that haven't developed to the point of dealing with this kind of mature statements and conversations are trying to address it and not being able to address it fully or with the self-awareness that, you know, I can play a role in this too. They figure if there's no hope for the parent, then what chance do I have? And how do they – because, you know, children and younger minds do take more on than they really need to, and they assume a responsibility that they're currently not ready to hold. How do you see that making a difference, and how can basically a support group be formed to where they don't have to basically end their life to try and, like you said, get rid of that mental pain that they're going through?
Yeah, absolutely. You're touching on a really good point, and I don't want to get tangential so I can answer your question. The ways of this country, this nation right now, really sad state, and it doesn't matter what side of the fence you lie on with certain political topics. But the reality is this, we have seen a decline as both technology has advanced and conveniences are more so at our reach. We've seen a correlation between that and a decline in the ways in which people cope, and that's adults as well as children. And so this is, you know, me getting on my soapbox a little bit, just wanting to give a shout out to all of the adults. Whether you're a parent or not, that doesn't make any difference because we're all role models to children. We're all modeling them, you know, whether it's at church, whether we are, you know, the volunteer at the soup kitchen, whether we coach the local little league team, you know, what have you. Kids do look up to us. And, you know, we're hearing every day for several years now all of the suicides that are occurring at the junior high level, the high school level. And a lot of it goes back to what kids are seeing. I'm not going to throw my age out there, but when I was growing up, I had the luxury, the privilege at this point to see the elders in my family cope with loss, cope with tragedy, cope with death, cope with financial hardship in a different manner than a lot of children are seeing today. And, you know, not to throw out religious implications one way or the other, you know, but I got to see that. I got to see people fall back on religious support or friendship support or familial support, or people would go out and they would take a walk or they would exercise or they would do healthy coping skills. And that's what the children, the young adults of this generation are missing. Again, coming from a mental health standpoint, it's very common to have a teenager come into my office but struggling with what have you, you know, whether it's sexuality or you name it, bullying, whatever the hot topic may be. And when I ask them, well, what coping skills do you have? Well, I don't know. Well, what coping skills are displayed to you at home? Well, my mom drinks. You know, my dad kicks the dog. My big brother smokes a lot of marijuana. You know, that's what's happening. And so immediate gratification, coping skills, that's what we're teaching people now. You know, you don't like something, you go out, you beat it up. You pop a pill, you do what have you. And eventually those things don't work because they're not addressing the real issue. And so once people discover that those things don't work and they don't have an appropriate healthy set of coping skills to fall back on, that can get them into the place of being helpless and hopeless. So, you know, when you say, what can we do? How can we identify things to help people? It really starts with the foundation of having a support system that can help instill coping skills, or at least direct to resources where coping skills can be taught, administered, what have you, so that people aren't feeling alienated and alone and continuing to do self-destructive things that are just going to get them into a darker place.
Yes. And one of the things, and especially, you know, I'm using this as an extreme, and that's the girlfriend that talked to her boyfriend into killing himself. And words make a difference, and words hurt. And I think that, like you said, we live in this very macho, very aggressive society that deems it unworthy, you know, to have feelings to the point that you say, hey, you know, that hurts, and I wish you'd say something a little bit different. And it, with that as the barometer or the you know, the balancing point, then we're pretty much not really balanced to begin with. So, like, the extremes are very extreme, and the moderates or the people that are in between are actually a little bit too silent. How do we get more back to center, more back to balance, and a society that has a little bit more compassion and concern?
That's a hard question. You know, the very idealistic answer is that we continue to educate ourselves, and we have moments like this podcast where we're talking about things, and we get out of being, you know, we're in a strange time. There's so much hatred going on in this country and so much divide. But at the same time, we still are almost enslaved to this PC sort of lifestyle. You know, we can't say certain things because it's offensive, but we can go out and we can do offensive things, or we can vote for offensive things. We need to get real. Just to be 100%, we need to start having conversations. We need to educate ourselves. We need to quit worrying about, and no offense by me using this example, but we need to quit worrying about what the Kardashians are doing and Angelina and Brad, and whether they're divorced or married or how many kids they have, and start really being concerned about real topics that are affecting, you know, the majority of American households. That's what we need to do. And how do we do that? I wish I had the answer. You know, I think it needs to start at the dinner table. I think families need to start having conversations. I think that people need to have places where they feel safe to open up and talk about whatever topic needs to be discussed without being concerned about, you know, being ostracized or almost exiled from their circle.
Wow. Yeah, and it's a tough call because there's so much that's going on. You really have to, honestly, you'd have to get the family environment back into the family just to even start that conversation. And that's such a rare thing in this nation. I know there's plenty of families that have that dynamic, but there's plenty more. And like I said, because we're not balancing out, the balance seems to be imbalanced. And that's what we're running with because it's, I don't want to say normal, but it is like standardized or habit, but it's not normal.
Sure.
I think we've lost sight of normal. And I think basically our children and, well, not even children, you're talking 50, 60-year-old people that are basically ending their lives because they basically have no will or want to live. So
right.
With that in mind, when we're trying to get the family dynamic back, what would be like the most basic thing? Because I know sitting at the dinner table seems to be a stretch. What would be another way?
Sure. Well, and when I say at the dinner table, I'm using that loosely because you're right. I mean, this isn't 1950s America anymore. So one thing I do want to address before I directly answer your question is family, in this day and age especially, that is it is not probably what most people think of as family, meaning that blood or marriage tie. You know, family is it can include the people that are closest to you, that are most supportive, that love you, you know, with limited conditions. I'm not going to say unconditionally, but with limited conditions. And so going to a coffee shop, as an example, with my best friend and potentially a blood relative and potentially my significant other and my child and you know, a couple of very close coworkers that I've known that have supported me through the years, that's family. As an example. And so, again, it doesn't necessarily have to be family of origin sitting down literally every day after school and work and having an hour-long conversation about things. But, again, the message that I'm trying to get out is the open arena for conversation, wherever that is. I think what we've got to do is we've got to get over the fact that certain things are taboo, quote unquote, and we shouldn't talk about certain things. You know, so as an example, and again, not to keep posing towards the religious example, but why can't we talk about suicide in church? Why can't we talk about sex in church? Why can't we talk about suicide, you know, when we are at our child's sports banquet? I mean, maybe not there. That might not be appropriate. But you get the example that I'm trying to make here. It doesn't have to be this closeted conversation or this closeted topic that we can only talk to those that are in some sort of secret society, and how you even find a secret society, I don't know, to even be have, you know, to begin to have the conversation. We need to just stop being scared and stop talking. People need to go out to different social events where there's awareness. I know that there's suicide walks and survivor talks and support groups and fundraisers. And, you know, if people are very passionate about these topics, they'll go to those events. But the vast majority of people, they don't know when these things are occurring. And so, again, they're in the dark, and they're not getting educated, and the awareness isn't there until, sadly, and not just with suicide, with anything, with terminal illness, with, you know, any sort of hot topic. where there's a tragedy. That's when the majority of people are put in the know, you know, about whatever it is, because it happened to my friend, my spouse, my cousin, my et cetera, et cetera.
You know, and that's good, guys. This is Desiree.
Hey,
Des. I finally made it back on. Hey. So I'm on my way back from Colorado, so sorry I missed the beginning of the show. My clock was off. But anyway, I was just thinking the exact same thing, Shalene, when you were talking about, you know, how the awareness isn't there. And this is one of those areas where unless it happens to you, it is not something that is top of mind. Unless it happens or until it happens to someone that you know or that is close to you, it is not top of mind. And therefore, it's not something that I'm looking to become educated about, because let's face it, it's not a happy thing. It's not a joyful thing. It's a painful thing to deal with. So if it's a painful thing to deal with, if I don't have to deal with it, why am I going to put myself in a position to deal with it? But I think that's exactly
the type
of thinking that we have to overcome, because by the time you do have to deal with it, unfortunately, if that happens to be you, it's too late, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I touched on that just hi, Desiree, by the way.
Hey.
I touched on that a little bit earlier when I was talking about the lack of coping skills that the majority of us have in this society right now. We don't want to deal with pain, and we do whatever is modeled to us. Just to kind of give you a quick summary of what I had said before, we don't want to do deal with pain, and so we do what is modeled to us to cope with painful situations. And when I'm saying pain, again, I'm referring more so to emotional and mental pain, but obviously no one likes to be in physical pain either. So due to the advancements in technology and the conveniences that we've had, a lot of people have lost that art of having those natural self-soothing coping skills. They're not seeing that modeled. And as I had said earlier, what people tend to do is oftentimes they'll do self-destructive things to cope.
Mm-hmm.
And when the self-destructive things no longer work, you know, when I've done, you know, enough heroin that I don't get high anymore and I just feel normal, quote unquote, whatever normal means, or I just don't feel the physical pain of withdrawal, now I'm stuck with whatever's happening in my head. And so I have to figure out a way to make that stop. And again, not to just keep repeating myself, but that's where that helplessness and hopelessness comes in. And those are prime ingredients for suicide attempts and suicide completion. But you're right. People do whatever they can do to avoid pain at most costs. And I think, again, that's a sad reflection of where we are currently in this nation, probably in other nations that run like the United States similarly. And until we can understand that not everything has to be for entertainment or a fun topic, or we've got to be politically correct in all circumstances or what have you, I sadly don't see where we're going to see a lot of advancement in the hot topics that we have in our society, the social problems that we have in our society, including suicide.
Yes. Now, like I said earlier before we came on live, that America as a nation is very behind the curve. I mean, incredibly behind. And unfortunately, in Chicago, I was actually up in the city when they closed down a lot of the mental institutions, and it was just shocking because basically anyone that was in there that was a patient was basically shown the door and just let loose amongst society. And, you know, granted, that's a terrible thing, but then you also have to think about, okay, what about the future when you're talking about the people that are going to be having mental health issues in the future? these people had some sort of direction, but now you have people that don't have coping skills, and they're basically being left unaddressed. And if they go to the, you know, the criminal system, that's not an aid either. And then they're interacting with society as a whole. I'm saying that's a really bad mix. And like you said, there's a lot of overlap and where to start and what to do, but we've got a lot of areas that need to be covered and addressed. And how has that been, you know, basically wreaking havoc on society in general?
You're hitting a lot of things on the nail right now. Yes, don't even get me started on the ways of healthcare in this country in general. But, you know, as I had stated earlier, the majority of suicides that are occurring, and that includes attempts, people have mental health issues. And that's a whole spectrum of things. That means a lot of different things. And then pair that with substance use or abuse or addiction, and we've got a really bad problem. I know I struggle every day. I have clients call me daily, family members, friends of clients saying such and so-and-so is in a really bad way, and they're not medicated, and they refuse to be medicated, and we're concerned, and we don't know what's going to happen. And what this country has decided to do with mental health, besides closing down a lot of facilities, a lot of resources, is they have basically said people cannot be forced into getting help unless they are homicidal or suicidal. So if you remember what I had said earlier, I had touched on suicide risks and assessing if someone's suicidal. It's very much so a case-by-case thing. So some people may vocalize that, others may not. So how are we getting people help if we've put such a one-size-fits-all, you know, outfit, for lack of a better word, on who we're going to help and how we're going to help them? And so in a shorter way to answer your question, what needs to happen is that we need to definitely go back and review a lot of the different policies and procedures and laws and regulations that are occurring on the multiple layers of, again, the social problems in our society. We need to revamp our legal system. We need to revamp our healthcare system. We need to, you know, provide more support and more resources to children, to families. Again, whatever family may look like, whether it's, you know, the very traditional father, mother, children, whether it is, you know, children that come from a one-parent household or children that have parents that are of the same sex, or whatever the case may be, we're like an onion. And that's what this society is. It's an onion. And you peel back the layers. It's just cultures within cultures within cultures, layers within layers within layers. And we don't live in a society where we can just slap a one-size-fits-all on everything anymore. And I see that as being a really big problem. It doesn't matter. When I'm talking about culture, I don't just mean race or sexuality or religion. I mean, I'm a woman. I identify as a woman as an example. My story isn't like every other woman. But just because I'm a woman, that doesn't mean that someone can tell me, okay, well, you have to do this, 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 and this, and then you and the other, you know, 3.5 billion women in this world, you're all be fine if you just do this thing. There's just so many different layers. And I think those are the things that need to be addressed.
Gotcha. And hey, guys, I have to apologize. I'm a little technologically advanced since I am disadvantaged. Oh, my goodness.
There you go.
Since I am on the road. So sorry about that. But I do know we have some listener questions that are coming in. Kaylin, I know we've got one from Dana that's been sitting there at the top of the list that we haven't had a chance to ask. Could you go ahead and read that one for us so we can get Shalene's thoughts on what she's asking?
Okay. This is a tough one. Dana's sister was basically had a straight-A student, and she's been doing well for years and years, and then all of a sudden she started feeling pressure for those straight A's. She's getting ready for college, and she started acting out. And, you know, cut it short, she got in trouble with the law, and, you know, the law took a look at her background and saw, you know, maybe she might just be going through something as an adolescent, and they decided to drop the charges. And the mother, you know, wanted her to understand the seriousness of what she did, and she didn't let her know, and her daughter took her life. Well, now the mother's in the point where she's blaming herself, and she's wanting to detach from life, you know, and she's basically not interacting with family like she normally does. Like you said, the things in the beginning. What can she do to basically keep from having two losses in 1 year from suicide?
Sure. The best thing that she can do is to be there for her mother. And when I say be there, be that sounding board. I'm not suggesting she be in the role of a therapist, but really listen to her mother, provide resources, check in on her, try to, you know, get her to socialize more. It definitely sounds like the mother is suffering from some what we call complicated grief, some survivor's guilt. And so I would strongly encourage the mother to go and seek out some therapeutic services in whatever venue that she feels comfortable, whether that be with a professional or with, you know, someone in a religious capacity, perhaps even finding a support group at a local hospital, in the newspaper if different, you know, warning or suicide survivor groups are listed. And don't alienate the mom. That's most important. Sadly, I know a lot of times people don't like this answer, but we can't make anybody do or feel or say anything. And so that gets frustrating, especially when we want the best for somebody. But people have to be willing to do things and make changes. And so realistically, all that Dana can do is again, just, you know, not be overbearing and preachy and teachy by any means, but just let her mother know that she's there. And again, that, you know, these are resources that I found. You know, hey, there's a festival going on out in the community, Mom. Let's go to that. Let's get you out of the house. You know, we don't want you sinking any deeper into the depression that you are in.
Mm-hmm. And
you know, and I think.
Go
ahead. I'll come back with my thought.
Okay. Well, Diane was wanting to know, like, instead of just pamphlets and flyers, what kind of outlets can the people get to, especially her, because she's dealing with actually three. Basically covering the East Coast, the Midwest, and the West Coast. I think this was a chain decision, a group. What kind of like hands-on information can they get hold of or someone to talk to so they can basically ensure that this happens to any other family?
Sure, that's a great question. There's a lot of, I hate to say it, but hidden resources. Again, people don't know where to go until tragedy has struck them personally. NAMI, N is in nickel, A, M is in milk, I, is a great organization that discusses all kinds of different aspects of mental health related things, and it's nationwide. So with the spread out of the different family members across, you know, basically the entire United States, that would be a great resource to go to. And they will probably have very specific things that they can direct people to within each of those regions. Believe it or not, United Way is another great resource. It's a very easy number to remember. It's 211, just like 911. There's no extra charge on your cell phone, your landline, what have you. That's going to tap you immediately into whatever region that you're in so you can, again, get resources. There are several different suicide websites, organizations that you can go through to access resources. Local hospitals and funeral homes actually tend to also be great resources for support groups, survivor talks, survivor walks, fundraisers. I'm trying to think what else off the top of my head. The suicide hotline, another great resource. I think in a situation like this, and that's, I love that question because we see that. You know, you go to your local family care physician, and if, you know, that clinic or that facility is bold enough, and I'm being sarcastic when I say bold, to have a pamphlet laying out, that's a lot of times, you know, again, going back to that taboo, hush-hush, we can't talk about things. I'm trying to provide you with information, but not really. So I think in a situation where you're dealing with suicide, suicide prevention, what have you, having someone that you can talk to directly, not even just reading something on a website. And so, again, I really strongly suggest looking up the local NAMI chapter and calling them directly, United Way, or, again, local hospitals and funeral homes.
Thank you.
Very good. And that was, and I had, you know, that same question, and I'm glad that our listeners have asked that. And just to take a step back to what Dana was asking and what she could do for her mother, just to try to be that support system. And I liked the options or the examples of ways that she could be there that you gave. And I just wanted to add on, and part of it too is in taking the taboo out of it that you've been talking about is, you know, sometimes you just have to ask, would you like to talk to somebody? You know, and make it an area that is okay for you to be talking about in your own home, you know, much more having it being talked about outside of the home. And I think that's a first important step to start. And I just say that because of my three children, I have one that battled with anxiety and different issues and was actually brave enough to say that they wanted help, that they wanted to speak with someone. But prior to that, I had conversations with my kids, not necessarily dealing about suicide, but just dealing with, you know, the divorce that I had with their father. And do you want to speak with someone? Can we speak with someone as a family? How can I help you, you know, deal with these emotions and feelings that you're having? And I think as part of that in letting them know that it's okay to get that kind of help, helped my one child in particular know that it was okay to say, I want that kind of help. And, you know, at least in me personally, I think that was, that went a long way to, you know, having them feel comfortable with even seeking that level of support.
I think that that's great that you shared that, Des. I really do. And I think you're absolutely right. That's a really good thing to piggyback on the things that I had suggested. And again, in breaking the taboo-ness and being able to start a conversation. And I think it goes back again to the PC thing. We're too scared to talk about things because we don't know how people react. And you bring up a really good point. So for all of the listeners out there that do have emerging adults, you know, people that are in traditional college age, teenagers, I think that one thing we have to, and I have a teenage daughter myself, one thing that we have to realize is that no matter what you have gone through or going through with those children or young adults, you're still mom, dad, guardian, grandma, grandpa, you know, whatever your role is. And those children are always seeking approval. Even when they're acting out, they want acceptance and approval from those that are rearing them. And they don't want to be in situations where they have created discomfort or potential dislike. You know, very quickly, the prefrontal cortex, so the front part of your brain, it's not done cooking, as I say, that's a joke, until you're about 24 years old. So what we older listeners may be able to understand, someone that's 16 may not. And so in terms of tolerance and accepting people, even if they have flaws, unconditional love, those kinds of things, you know, a 16-year-old, a 13-year-old, a 20-year-old doesn't understand. So creating that environment where you can have those children and young adults vocalize their concerns.
And I'm going to get back to the questions. We got two, one from Jacob, and he's asking, you know, since we've been covering this a couple of times on our show, he's asked, how bad is suicide in America? And the second question, okay, I think I got it wrong. The second one is basically, what do you do when you're dealing with parental denial that their child might be, you know, at risk?
Good question.
That's a great question. I'm going to answer the second part of his question first. Jacob, reach out to whoever you need to reach out to. Again, I know I've thrown out some resources already. Again, NAMI, United Way, Suicide Hotline. Depending on the age of the child that you're referring to, if they are, you know, still in a traditional school setting, you know, college on down through the, you know, junior high, potentially, sadly, in this day and age, the elementary school years, you know, go to that guidance counselor, that PE teacher, your Cub Scouts leader, you know, the gymnastics coach, whomever that you trust, and always talk to somebody. We always want it to be a parent, but that's not always the case. Sometimes parents don't give us what we want or need. And so you find that person or those people that can step in and be in that caring / parental role. Can you please repeat the first part of Jacob's question?
He was thinking, wanting to know just how bad suicide is, because, you know, I've said it's all, if it would have been an epidemic, we would have shut down half the country, because it's that bad. But he wants to know actual numbers.
Well, actual numbers they vary. I can tell him worldwide, and this is approximately a couple of years ago, we're losing about 1 million people to suicide in this country. And so that's a pretty big number. It is an epidemic, and our country is great at not paying attention to epidemics. We have a horrific opioid drug epidemic going on right now, and no offense to any of the law enforcement or substance abuse counselors or whomever may be listening in on this right now, because it's not a personal stab at you, but we're not doing a thing to take care of it. And it truly is an epidemic. People are dying left and right. The overdose rates in this country are, I mean, out of this world. They match nothing in history in terms of drug use. So suicide, again, it's one of those things where it's very, very taboo and we don't want to talk about it. And it's bad. It's bad. It's very common, you know, just to give people an idea of what's going on. Males, white males in particular, ages 35 to about 64 are at highest risk. Again, you add in substance use, abuse, addiction, along with mental health issues and certain circumstantial hardships, perhaps, you know, a divorce, loss of job, loss of a child, et cetera, et cetera, financial hardship, and the rates just skyrocket. So it happens more often than people care to speak about. Firearm is still the number one method of completed suicides. However, we are seeing a huge trend in suffocation as a way to complete suicide, with hangings, self-inflicted hangings being the number one in that category. So this really is an issue. It's an epidemic. It's a problem. It's happening more and more in realms where people would never expect it to. I don't have the statistics. I apologize to everybody. But in rural communities across the country, the suicide rates have really skyrocketed within the last 10 years. So we're seeing different populations, even non-traditional ones, per statistics, showing extremely high rates in comparison to history in terms of the occurrence of suicide attempts and completions.
And that, I mean, that is staggering. I mean, epidemic is a word that I would have used to describe this too, but just to hear the few numbers that you do have, because I know research is always lagging and it doesn't always keep pace with the way that society is trending, but it does give a pretty decent snapshot of how all of that is happening. And just to tag on to the questions that Jake is answering, I know everybody is different, and as you said, some individuals vocalize their thoughts regarding suicide. Others don't. Some act out physically, say, for instance, you know, maybe cutting, which is something that has become more popular in our younger age groups. You know, what are some of the more telltale physical signs, maybe, that might indicate someone is contemplating or is more prone to suicide than maybe another individual, if they've even been categorized as such?
Sure. And I did touch on that a little bit earlier, Des. I know you weren't able to chime in right at the beginning.
Yeah. Sorry, guys.
As I've stated before, you know, so you're dealing a lot of times with someone that has mental health issues, and again, that's a spectrum. I am the last person that wants to put a stigma, any more stigma, on mental health. And so we could be talking anything from anxiety, depression, all the way up to someone that's having psychotic features, you know, or maybe a full-blown schizophrenia and everything in between. And so all of those, you know, I wish we had more time. All of those present so differently. So it's really hard to just put your thumb down on, well, it's going to be this, 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 and this. But I did throw some things out earlier that I'll touch on again. So knowing the person, picking up on things that are uncharacteristic for them can be a telltale sign. So as an example, as I had said earlier, if you have someone that very much so on you know, an average run-of-the-mill day is very high-functioning, very productive, you know, very work-oriented, very hygienic, maybe does those extra grooming things that, you know, we kind of smile about in society. So, you know, hair done, nails done, makeup, you know, clean clothes, those kinds of things. If they start doing the opposite, you know, or maybe even dramatic weight gain, weight loss. If you see them do, you know, wearing clothing maybe that's covering up their arms, their legs more, if they normally would, you know, show those parts of their bodies off, those all might be telltale signs that, you know, when you touched on cutting and self-mutilation, that's what I'm referencing with the change in clothing. But maybe a complete change in mood and some feelings of helplessness and hopelessness setting in if people are doing the opposite of what they were doing before. On the flip side, if someone has always been just sort of, I referred to it earlier as having a melancholy sense about them, meaning, you know, kind of just a low-grade depression, that's just sort of their personality, and all of a sudden they're extremely upbeat and happy, and you know, it feels as though they're wearing this fake mask of happiness and joy, that may be an indicator. If people are starting to give away items that have extreme sentimental value to them, things that they normally would never want to part with, sometimes even having discussions about what their wishes may be if they were to pass away or who they would like things to go to, that may be an indicator. And again, I don't want to have people on high alert here because, you know, there are times where it wouldn't be odd that someone was talking about what their wishes were if they were to pass away. You know, as an example, if you have mm-hmm. a very close loved one pass away, it wouldn't be odd for grandma to sit down with the family and say, hey, these are my wishes. So I don't want people to, again, go completely overboard with the things that I'm saying, but I'm talking about seeing a pattern. Mm-hmm. where it doesn't have a logical or relevant stance on what's going on, you know, in that person's life.
It's a behavior that keeps continuing. It's not just a once-in-a-lifetime, well, not once-in-a-lifetime, but, you know, just a blip. It's something that they're seeing happening over and over and over again.
Absolutely.
Okay. This is a topic we can continue to talk about. I mean, I don't know that you ever get to a point where you can answer all of the questions, and we're definitely not going to be able to do that tonight. We've only got a few minutes left. So with that, I do want to say thank you, Shalene, for coming on and sharing all of your insight and information that you've had with us. And I know that I've asked you to repeat several things, and I apologize, guys, I was on the show late, but I know we have listeners joining us at different points of the program, so, you know, my prayer is that it's still been helpful to those who are able to join us late. And just one last time, if you already covered this, out of all of the information that you shared this evening, just kind of give us your top 1, 2, 3 bullet points of what folks should take away as far as, you know, I guess suicide prevention, if you will, or just some highlight things that out of everything you said tonight, the most important things that you think they should remember from this show.
Sure. Well, definitely. I think that we need to start having conversations with our loved ones and those in our community about the topic of suicide. We need to educate ourselves. We need to become more aware and to, you know, piggyback that or onto that. Again, I'm going to throw out the names of those resources so that people can begin that education process, whether it be with their children or again, you know, in different aspects of their community. NAMI, again, N as in nickel, A, M as in milk, I, wonderful organization, deals with all different aspects of mental health topics. United Way, very easy phone number, it's 211. Both of these organizations are nationwide, so it doesn't matter where you're at. If you may be dealing with a situation like this and you need to get immediate resources, as well as the suicide hotline. And then I think the third thing is just to understand again that, you know, I really only touched on this very briefly in the beginning of the podcast, but suicide is no one's fault. And again, with becoming more educated, we need to understand and reframe the way that we think about suicide. Again, it is not a selfish act that is done by someone to punish others. It's an act that occurs when someone just feels so extremely helpless and hopeless. They see no other way to stop mental and emotional pain, sometimes accompanied even with physical pain, and feel as though they're a burden to those around them. And so, you know, a lot of times people will have survivor guilt and say, well, if only I had known, I could have done this, I could have done that. And, you know, it's not that anybody could have done anything, but provide resources to the best of their ability and open up that door to talk and communicate and be supportive and be that sounding board. So I think that those are my major take homes for the evening.
And those are all good ones. So, again, thank you very much for being with us. And I just want to add that, you know, the audio form, our podcasts are always available within, you know, 15 to 30 minutes after the close of the show. They're always available in our archives. So if you heard anything in this program that you think would be helpful to someone else, or you just want to listen to it again for your own information, be sure to download it, share it, send the link, and just get the word out there as much as possible. And with that being said, we are out of time. So on behalf of Ms. Cunningham, with you have our gratitude again for sharing with us today, Kaylin, the boys at P4P Muscle, and myself, your body is a temple, so let's build it.